their gross suffering and gives them contact with kind people. This may awaken their interest in spiritual practice. On the one hand, no person is an island, and we need to reach out and help each other. On the other, meditation is a solitary pursuit that is necessary to develop wisdom and compassion. Must we choose between meditation and activity? Or can they be balanced? Both are important. Meditation enables us to purify our hindrances and to increase our good qualities so that when we reach out to others, we'll be effective. Just as a person who wants to cure others' illnesses studies in medical school before treating patients, a person who wishes to benefit others by showing them the Dharma path must study and practice before guiding others. Meditation provides the time and space to look within and to concentrate on developing good qualities and diminishing harmful ones. Activity in society gives us the opportunity to act according to the understandings we've developed through meditation. Interacting with others is like the proof of the pudding, where what we still need to work on becomes clear. In addition, actively helping others enriches our mind streams with positive potential, so that our meditation can progress. Because each of us is unique, we will balance these two things in different ways in our lives, and we may shift the balance between them from time to time, sometimes being more active, other times more contemplative. During the times we emphasize meditation, we must be careful that our altruism does not become abstract and intellectual. Similarly, while we're more active, we must meditate every day in order to retain a calm center from which to act. How can we prevent burnout when we are working for others' welfare? One way is to keep checking our motivation, continually renewing our compassionate intention. Another is to assess what we're capable of doing and to make realistic commitments. Sometimes we may be so inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal that we agree to participate in every project that comes our way, even though we may lack the time or ability to complete it. As a result of overcommitment, we may push ourselves to the point of exhaustion or begin to resent those who are counting on our help. We should survey the situation and our capabilities well before we commit and accept only those responsibilities that we can carry out. In addition, we must remember that difficulties and dissatisfaction are the nature of cyclic existence. Preventing nuclear waste, opposing oppression, stopping the destruction of rainforests, and helping the homeless are noble projects. However, even if all these goals were achieved, all the world's ills would still not be solved. The chief source of suffering lies in the mind. As long as ignorance, attachment, and anger are present in people's minds, there will be no lasting peace on the earth. Thus, expecting our social welfare work to go smoothly, becoming attached to the results of our efforts, or thinking, if only this would happen, the problem would be solved, sets us up for discouragement when our aspirations are not actualized. We need to remember that in cyclic existence, there are better and worse states, but all are temporary, and none bring ultimate freedom. If we are realistic, we can work in the world without expecting to bring about paradise on earth. And we can also follow our spiritual practice, knowing that it will ultimately lead to the cessation of our own and others' suffering. Should we continue to try to help people who don't accept our help? Each situation must be examined individually. First, we must check our motivation for helping others. Is it because we think we know what's best for this poor person who cannot get his life together? Is it because we want to feel needed? If we have such attitudes, we're likely to try to force our advice on others, which will cause them to recoil. We must also examine ourselves to discover if we've acted skillfully or if our help has undermined others' sense of self-esteem. In trying to help, have we left others feeling humiliated? Have we tried to fix their problem with the solution we consider best for them without consulting them? In such a case, our motivation may have been tainted with self-centeredness, even though we thought we were acting for others' benefit. Sometimes we have acted in good faith and with skill, but others are unreceptive or even hostile to our efforts. In this situation, we should stop active help, but still keep the door of communication open so that if they change later on, they'll feel comfortable contacting us. Stomping away from situations in which we've unsuccessfully tried to help and complaining, "See how much I've done for you and you don't appreciate it," increases others' resentment and prevents them from seeking our aid in the future. Sometimes acceptance, patience, and inaction are the most effective ways we can be of aid. Are Buddhists concerned about the environment? They need to be. Unfortunately, many people lack education on this subject. Even when environmental issues make the headlines, some Buddhists neglect to engage in simple acts, such as recycling, to protect the environment. Taking care to recycle our cans, jars, bottles, and paper is part of the practice of mindfulness in our homes. Compassion and concern for others should motivate us to minimize the use of disposable, non-recyclable materials in temples and Dharma centers, and to recycle the materials we can. A significant number of Western and Asian Buddhists are concerned about the environment and are involved in socially engaged projects. The Buddhist Peace Fellowship, Box 4650, Berkeley, California, 94704, is noteworthy and can supply reading lists, addresses of socially engaged Buddhist organizations worldwide, and back issues of their excellent journal. The Path of Compassion, edited by Fred Epsteiner and published by Parallax Press, provides a Buddhist perspective on social engagement. Does Buddhism give guidelines for protection of the environment? Yes. Interdependence, protecting life, and loving kindness are three of the Buddha's most important teachings. Interdependence refers to the interrelationship of phenomena. In this case, sentient beings and the environment depend upon each other for survival, and thus it's in the interest of human beings to protect the environment. Traditionally, Buddhists advocate nonviolence and the protection of life. Because humans, animals, and insects are life forms, Buddhism advocates the preservation of endangered species. In addition, as an expression of loving kindness for ourselves, future generations, and all beings, Buddhism stresses the protection not only of the earth on which all of us depend, but also the protection of all sentient life on it. Attachment is one of the chief causes of humankind's exploitation of the environment. Craving for more and better causes us to take all we can from the earth and to ignore the long-term consequences of this. If we lessen our attachment by developing contentment with what we have, we will be able to live more harmoniously with our environment and the other beings who share it with us. What does Buddhism say about animal rights? Buddhism regards animals as living beings who experience pleasure and pain, and who cherish their own lives just as humans do. Therefore, Buddhists would not advocate putting homeless cats and dogs to sleep, nor would they condone cruel experimentation on animals, the dreadful living conditions of animals raised for slaughter, or killing animals to have fur coats or sheepskin rugs. Although theoretically Buddhism favors vegetarianism, it is not required, and many Buddhists are not vegetarians. Why do people in some Buddhist traditions eat meat, while those in others are vegetarian? Initially, it may seem confusing that the Theravadins of Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia eat meat. The Chinese Mahayanists do not. The Japanese Mahayanists do. And the Tibetans, who practice the Vajrayana, do. This difference depends on the varying emphasis of each tradition. Theravadin teachings emphasize eliminating attachment toward sense objects and counteracting the discriminating mind that says, "I like this and not that." Thus, when the monastics collect alms, they are to accept silently and with gratitude whatever is offered to them, be it meat or not. If monastics said, "I cannot eat meat, so give me more of those delicious vegetables," the benefactors would be offended, and the monastic's practice of non-attachment would be harmed. Thus, provided that the meat comes from an animal that the monastic neither kills himself, orders to be killed, or sees, hears, or suspects is killed to provide him with meat, he is permitted to eat it. However, those who offer food to the Sangha should remember that the principal premise of Buddhism is not to harm others, and should choose what they offer accordingly. Upon the basis of non-attachment, the Mahayana tradition emphasizes compassion for other beings. Thus, a practitioner of this tradition is advised not to eat meat in order to avoid inflicting pain on any being, and to prevent potential butchers from committing negative actions. Also, the ignorant, lusty, or aggressive energy of an animal can affect an ordinary practitioner who eats its flesh, thus impeding his or her development of great compassion. Therefore, vegetarianism is recommended. The Chinese Mahayana monks and nuns are strict vegetarians, while the lay people may eat meat. Although Japanese Buddhism is Mahayana, both the priests and the lay people generally eat meat. This is due to the geography of Japan, where people have depended on the sea as a food source for centuries. The tantric path, or Vajrayana, has four classes. In the two lower classes, external cleanliness and purity are emphasized as techniques to help the practitioner generate internal purity of mind. Therefore, these practitioners do not eat meat, which is regarded as impure. On the other hand, in the highest yoga tantra, on the basis of non-attachment and compassion, a qualified practitioner employs the subtle nervous system in meditation. For this, one's bodily elements need to be very strong, and thus eating meat is recommended for such a person. Also, this class of tantra stresses the transformation of ordinary objects through meditation on selflessness. Such practitioners, by virtue of their profound meditation, are not greedily eating meat for their own pleasure. In Tibet, an additional factor must be considered. Due to the high altitude and harsh climate, there is little to eat besides ground barley, dairy products, and meat. The people had to eat meat to stay alive. However, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has encouraged the Tibetans living in exile in countries where vegetables and fruits are more plentiful to refrain from eating meat whenever possible. If practitioners suffer severe health problems, their spiritual masters may encourage them to eat meat. In this way, they can keep their bodies healthy to use it for Dharma practice. The Buddha prohibited all of his followers, ordained and lay, from eating meat under three circumstances. 1. When they kill the animal themselves. 2. When they ask another person to kill it for them. Or 3. When they know or suspect that someone killed the animal to feed to them. By avoiding meat obtained in any of these three ways, people do not create the negative action of killing. The question then arises, what about eating meat bought at the market? Many teachers say that is permissible. My personal opinion is that some karma must be involved simply because consumer demand creates the supply of meat, which entails the taking of lives. However, this karma would be different from that created by directly killing the animal oneself. If one does eat meat, eating the flesh of large animals is recommended. This minimizes the number of lives that are taken to provide a meal. Only one cow loses its life to provide many people with several meals, whereas many shrimp must die to give one person only one meal. People who eat meat are also encouraged to develop a sense of gratitude and compassion for the animals who have given their lives so they can eat. In this way, they will aspire to practice the Dharma well to repay the kindness of the animals. Also, non-vegetarians can recite the mantra, Om Abhirake Sarahum, 7 times over the meat, and pray for the animal to have a fortunate rebirth. We cannot brand people as good Buddhists or bad Buddhists by looking at their dinner plates. Those who eat meat with a sense of gratitude and compassion for the animal may be more spiritual than fundamentalist vegetarians who are intolerant of anything but their own view. Each person must check his or her own level of practice, bodily requirements, and the food source in their environment and eat accordingly, without insisting that everyone else eat as he or she does. What we eat does not make us enlightened, but what we do with our minds does. Is organ donation considered beneficial according to Buddhism? In general, offering parts of one's body for the benefit of others is virtuous. Nowadays, this is much easier than in the past because a kidney, for example, can frequently be transplanted from one person to another without great complications. However, each case must be regarded separately, depending on one's motivation and the other's condition. Donating one's organs after death is a choice that will vary from person to person, depending on each individual's state of mind and level of spiritual practice. In some cases, removing organs after the heart has stopped but before the consciousness has left could interrupt the death process and be detrimental. In others, the force of the person's compassion and wish to benefit others can override any inconvenience that person may experience, and could be an ultimate act of caring for others. This is a personal decision. What is the Buddhist view on abortion? According to Buddhism, the consciousness joins with the fertilized egg at the moment of conception, and thus the embryo is a living being. Unwanted pregnancy is a difficult situation, and we must think creatively about how to help people who face it. There is no black and white answer. Each situation is unique. But no matter what choice is made, the pain cannot be denied. Currently, a great debate rages in America about abortion, and both sides claim to be right. However, I see much anger and very little compassion in both camps. Nevertheless, compassion for the parents and the child involved in an unwanted pregnancy is what is needed. We must try to find the best solution in a case where no perfect solution exists. And we must consider both the short and long-term effects on both the parents and the child. For example, abortion may terminate the pregnancy and solve the immediate problem, but the parents may have unresolved emotions afterward, and the karma they and the doctor create will adversely influence their future happiness. Better education and counseling about birth control, especially for teenagers, are needed. Young people also need realistic education about romance. But to teach that, adults must first develop and model it themselves. And that means dismantling the conditioning from the fairy tales and Hollywood stories we grew up with. Also, we should improve adoption services to help the many childless couples have children. I appreciate the choice that the natural parents of my adopted relatives and friends made. Without it, I would never have known those people who are now very dear to me. Is birth control allowed in Buddhism? Yes, depending on the method. Birth control methods that prevent conception are permitted. However, once conception has taken place and consciousness has entered the fertilized egg, it's a different situation. Thus, IUDs and other such methods are discouraged. What is the Buddhist view on the death penalty? Life is the most valuable possession any person has, even if that person acts in a criminal manner. Buddhism recommends rehabilitation or imprisonment rather than execution. The proper motivation is needed for imprisoning others, however. That is, imprisonment is to protect a person from harming others and from creating more negative karma that would bring him or her misery later. Seeking revenge or feeling glee at punishing others is opposite to the kind heart that Buddhism encourages us to develop. Is self-defense ever justifiable in light of the Buddhist emphasis on nonviolence? Self-defense does not need to involve violence. And nonviolence does not mean becoming a doormat. We can seek ways to protect ourselves from harm without harming others or by inflicting the least amount of harm necessary. With however much time is available, we can try to diminish our self-centeredness and reflect on compassion before acting. Someone who cherishes others more than him or herself would generally choose to give up his or her own life rather than slay another. In ancient times, a certain general was furious with a monk who refused to answer a question. Drawing his sword, the general shouted, "Do you know I could stick this into you without thinking twice?" The monk calmly replied, "And do you know I could have it stuck in me without thinking twice?" If we are unattached to our bodies and do not want to take the lives of others, we may be willing to give up our own lives. However, most of us are not capable of doing that with a happy mind. If we feel we cannot avoid killing, we can at least try not to rejoice in the action, but do it with regret at having to cause another pain. If our intention to cause harm is weak, the karmic effect of the act will be less. Purification will also help diminish the strength of the karma. What can we do in times of war or if someone threatens our loved ones? Seeking nonviolent means to handle difficult situations is always better. If we use our intelligence and creativity, we can often find other solutions. Surely diplomacy is more effective than war. No matter how difficult our situation, we always have a choice of how to act. We can distract or injure someone rather than kill him or her. If there is a war, we should consider carefully what choice to make. We should weigh the advantages and disadvantages of killing and not killing in this and in future lives, and we should examine the effects this action has on ourselves and others. Then we can decide according to what we consider best, or least harmful, although there may be no easy solution. What can we do about insects in our house? We can use creative ways to remove them. Killing them is not necessary. It may take a bit more time to put an ant on a piece of paper and carry it outside, or to catch a spider or cockroach in a plastic container and put it in the grass. But when we consider the consequences of killing and the fact that each insect cherishes its life just as we cherish ours, we won't mind the extra effort. Is killing ever permissible? In a story of one of Shakyamuni Buddha's previous lives as a bodhisattva, he was the captain of a ship. He knew that the oarsman was going to kill and rob the 500 merchants on board. He had intense compassion not only for the victims, but also for the oarsman, who would experience the torturous karmic results of killing so many people. In addition, he was willing to take upon himself any negative karmic effects of killing. He thus decided to take the oarsman's life. But because his motivation was pure, the karmic effect of killing was minimal, and he created great positive potential that propelled him on the bodhisattva path. Chapter 16. Women and the Dharma. Can both men and women attain liberation and enlightenment? Views on this differ among the various Buddhist traditions. According to the Vajrayana, both women and men are equally able to attain liberation and enlightenment. However, the Theravada and general Mahayana presentations say that although one can attain liberation with a female body, to attain full enlightenment, one has to have a male body in the very last rebirth. As a Buddha, one is beyond being either male or female. An enlightened being can manifest in any type of body, human or animal, male or female, that is beneficial for sentient beings. Our gender, like everything else, exists merely by being labeled. In this case, the label is designated in dependence on the cellular arrangement of our body. When we say, "I am female" or "I am male," that designation is based simply on the body we have this lifetime. In previous lives, each of us has been born male and female. When we watch our breath or observe our mind in meditation, we can clearly see that our mind is neither male nor female. In other words, there is nothing about us that is inherently male or female. Therefore, we should avoid making these labeled categories more solid than they actually are. Can women make offerings and prayers during menstruation? Can they meditate at that time? Of course, any notion that they cannot is superstition. Is it harder for a woman to practice the Dharma than for a man? A general statement cannot be made, for each individual is different. Some women find that their menstrual cycle causes many emotional changes, but they can learn to deal with them. After all, men can be moody too. I believe that the principal thing holding a woman back is lack of self-confidence and a limited vision of her potential due to societal values or family upbringing. If we think we cannot do something well, we don't even try. What a waste of human potential. We are human beings with human intelligence and have not only met the Dharma, but also have all the necessary conditions to practice and attain realizations. So let's do it. The success of our practice depends on our self-confidence and effort, not on others' opinions. Historically, many women have attained liberation and enlightenment. The Theragatha, some Mahayana sutras, and tantric biographies tell the stories of many female practitioners who became arhats, bodhisattvas, and Buddhas. Nowadays, too, we see women who are accomplished meditators, teachers, and leaders of Buddhist centers. Have women participated as equals in Buddhist institutions? In most Western and Asian cultures, women's activities have been more restricted and their social position lower than men's. The position and opportunities open to women in Western society have undergone much change in recent years, but haven't changed as much in Asia. In the 6th century BC, when the Buddha was alive, women were considered subordinate to men, and their societal roles were very restricted. Conforming with Indian values, the Buddha designated that the nuns sit behind the monks and be served after them, and that the nuns' community be under the care of the monks. This is due to the societal customs of ancient India, and is not indicative of women's intelligence or capability. In fact, while the male is representative of the method aspect of the path to enlightenment, the female is symbolic of the wisdom aspect. Although it's said that the Buddha initially refused to admit women into the monastic order, he soon consented to the establishment of a nuns' community composed of fully ordained women. These were revolutionary steps according to ancient Indian society. At that time, women were considered the property of first their fathers, then their husbands, and finally their sons. The Buddha's clear recognition of women's potential to attain liberation and enlightenment, and his encouraging them in their practice by giving them full ordination, was remarkable given the society in which he lived. Aside from the Jains, Buddhism was the only religion at that time to ordain women. Although women's capability to practice the Dharma and attain high realizations has traditionally been recognized, women have occupied second place in Buddhist institutions due to cultural prejudice. However, internal practice is very different from external power and recognition. A true practitioner is more concerned with the former than the latter. That doesn't mean, however, that women must complacently accept institutionalized cultural biases. We must work to remedy them, motivated not by pride or anger, but because we want all beings, men and women alike, to be able to practice well and attain enlightenment. In Buddhism, different levels of ordination exist for women. 8 precept holder, novice, sramanarika, probationary, siksamana, and fully ordained nun, bhikshuni. The level of ordination available to women differs from one country to another, and this influences how various Asian societies regard their ordained female practitioners. In the Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese traditions, women can take full ordination. Educated and active in society, many are spiritual masters themselves. In fact, Chinese nuns currently outnumber the monks. In contrast, the full ordination for women isn't available in Thailand, and the women who have taken 8 precepts have an ambiguous status between lay and ordained. In Sri Lanka, women may take 10 precepts, and they have a similar ambiguous status. Among the Tibetans, the novice ordination for women is available, but the lineage of full ordination did not spread to Tibet. Although there have been several great female practitioners in Tibet, few Tibetan women currently teach the Dharma. Women from Buddhist traditions that lack the lineage for women's full ordination are now interested in instituting this ordination in their tradition. Both monks and nuns are studying to determine how to transmit the ordination lineage from one tradition to another. Some women, both Asian and Western, have already gone to Taiwan, Hong Kong, France, or the USA to take the full ordination in Chinese, Vietnamese, or Korean temples. What can be done to improve the situation of nuns and female practitioners? As Buddhism comes to the West, cultural biases against women must and will be left behind, because present Western cultures won't tolerate them. In addition, such prejudice is harmful to both men and women. At present in the West, women are very active in Buddhist organizations and often are leaders or teachers. However, because sexual discrimination still exists, we must be vigilant and ensure that biases against women don't creep into Buddhist translations, rituals, or education in the West. In particular, all translations of Buddhist text and prayers should be gender-neutral, using terms such as Buddha's spiritual children instead of Buddha's sons when referring to bodhisattvas. New nunneries, nuns' communities, and educational institutions for women are being built in both Asia and the West. These need funds to operate and to help the Dharma flourish. Women who wish to do long retreats need support, as do those who organize social welfare programs, publish Dharma books, and translate texts. People could keep this in mind when they make offerings to support the Dharma. Since 1987, international conferences for Buddhist women have been regularly held, and Sakyadita, an international Buddhist women's organization, has been founded. At least 2 international newsletters for Buddhist women exist, and interest in improving all aspects of life for female practitioners is increasing. Seeing women from various cultures and traditions unite in their common aspiration to practice and actualize the Buddha's teachings is inspiring. Chapter 17. Monks, Nuns, and Lay Practitioners. What does taking ordination as a monk or nun entail? Ordination involves taking certain precepts or vows established by the Buddha and making an effort to live according to them. It is founded upon a person's commitment to steer her or his physical, verbal, and mental energies in productive directions instead of indiscriminately acting out any thought that comes to mind. The novice ordination consists of taking 10 precepts for life. These 10 are subdivided into 36 in the Tibetan tradition. Full ordination involves taking over 200 or 300 precepts, the number varying according to the Vinaya lineage and whether one is a man or woman. Lay people can also take vows, in this case called the 5 lay precepts. These are to abandon killing, stealing, unwise sexual behavior, lying, and intoxicants. Some lay people may also take the 8 precepts for life. The additional 3 are to abandon 1. Singing, dancing, playing music, and wearing ornaments, perfumes, and cosmetics. 2. Sitting on a high or expensive seat or bed. And 3. Eating after midday. When taking the 8 precepts for life, the 3rd precept is one of celibacy. In addition, a practitioner can take the 8 precepts for just one day. This practice is commonly done on new and full moon days, and on Buddhist festival days, although it may be done any day. When people decide that they would like to become a monk or nun or to take the 5 lay precepts, they request their teacher to grant them ordination. If the teacher feels that they have a proper foundation, he or she will arrange the appropriate ceremony. What are the benefits of taking ordination as a monk or nun? Is monastic ordination necessary to practice the Dharma? Becoming a monk or nun is not necessary to practice the Dharma. Taking ordination is an individual choice that each person must make for him or herself. Historically, many lay men and women have gained high realizations. It's inspiring to learn about their lives and to emulate them. However, there are some advantages to being ordained. By living within the precepts, one is constantly accumulating positive potential. As long as ordained people aren't breaking the precepts, they are continuously enriching their mind streams with positive potential even when they're asleep. They have more time for practice and encounter fewer distractions because family obligations can consume much time and energy. Children require a lot of attention, and it's difficult to meditate if they are playing or crying nearby. People who see these things as distractions and who want to pacify their minds and accumulate a rich store of positive potential may decide to take ordination to have a more conducive situation for practice. How can a lay person practice the Dharma? Lay men and women can practice the Dharma in the same way as everyone else, by subduing their minds. In some Buddhist cultures, some people underestimate their potential by thinking, "I'm a lay person. Listening to teachings, chanting, and meditating are the work of monks and nuns. It's not my job. I just go to the temple, bow, make offerings, and pray for the welfare of my family." While these activities are good, lay people are capable of a rich spiritual life in terms of both learning Buddhism and integrating it into their daily life. Attending Dharma talks on a regular basis and retreats whenever possible is important. By doing this, people will understand the real truth and beauty of the Dharma. Otherwise, they will remain joss stick Buddhists, people who go to the temple and offer joss stick incense with much ceremony and little understanding. And if someone asks them a question about Buddhism, they'll have difficulty in responding. That is a sad situation. Nevertheless, many Buddhists in both Asia and the West are eager to meditate and study the Dharma, and this is a good sign. Lay Buddhists can take the 5 lay precepts for the duration of their lives, or take 8 precepts on special days. In this way, they increase their practice of mindfulness as well as create much positive potential. In addition, they can attend weekend retreats and teachings at temples and Dharma centers, or use some of their annual vacation time to go on longer retreats. Responsibility for the existence and dissemination of the Buddha's teachings lies with the monks, nuns, and lay people. If we value the Buddha's teachings and want them to continue to exist and to flourish, we have the responsibility to learn and practice them ourselves according to our capabilities. Do people become monks and nuns to escape the harsh realities of life? Instead of escaping reality, sincere practitioners are trying to discover it. Chasing after sense pleasures, distracting ourselves by watching television, shopping, or drinking are ways of escaping reality. For these activities distract us from looking at the reality of death and the functioning of cause and effect. In the Dharma, this is seen as a form of laziness, because no effort is being made to subdue our attachment, anger, and closed-mindedness. Those who ask this question think that having a job, a mortgage, and a family are difficult tasks and constitute the harsh reality of life. But it is a much harsher reality to be honest with ourselves and to recognize our own mistaken conceptions and harmful behavior. People who meditate and pray may not be able to show a skyscraper or a paycheck as the sign of their success, but they are by no means lazy and irresponsible. Eliminating our anger, attachment, and closed-mindedness, and changing our destructive physical, verbal, and emotional habits is hard work. Much effort over a long time is necessary to become a Buddha. If people become monks or nuns thinking to have an easy life, their motivation is impure, and they will not find ordained life satisfying. The causes of suffering, attachment, ignorance, and anger, follow us everywhere. They don't need a passport to go with us to another country, nor are they left outside the monastery gates. If all we had to do to escape the hassles of life was to shave our head and put on robes, I think everyone would do it. But unfortunately, it's not that easy. As long as we have attachment, ignorance, and anger, we cannot escape problems, whether we are ordained or not. Some people think only people who cannot make it in the real world become monks and nuns. Maybe they have family problems, or they didn't do well in school, or they cannot get a good job. They live in the temple and take vows just to have a home and an occupation. Should people seek ordination for this reason, they lack the proper motivation. And the masters who give ordination need to weed such people out. On the contrary, those who take ordination with a correct motivation have strong aspiration to develop their potential, to subdue their minds, and to help others. Do all monks and nuns take the vow to be celibate, or may they marry? All monks and nuns take a vow to be celibate. In Japan, the tradition of lay priests developed. These people do not take vows of celibacy and may marry. Some priests shave their heads and wear robes. Others don't. In Tibetan Buddhism, one may be a layperson with a family and still be a spiritual teacher. Out of respect for the Dharma, such teachers sometimes wear clothes that resemble monastic robes, but are not. This is sometimes confusing for people who cannot tell the difference in the clothes and wonder why a monk or nun has long hair. Thus, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, asked these practitioners to add a white band to their shawls to indicate that they are lay, not monastic practitioners. Can someone be ordained for a short period of time, or must it be for one's entire life? This differs in each Buddhist tradition. In Thailand, a man may become a monk for a few weeks or months, and then return to lay life. Most young men in Thailand do this, and it's considered an honor for his family. In the other traditions, monastic ordination is taken for life. However, if a person is unhappy being ordained and later wants to leave the order, he or she may return the vows and resume lay life. Some people choose to take the 8 Mahayana precepts for a year, and their spiritual masters may give them permission to wear robes during this time, although they are technically still lay people. What is the relationship between the Sangha, monks and nuns, and lay practitioners? As the Buddha designed it, the Sangha's responsibility is to keep their vows, learn and practice the Dharma, and teach and guide the lay people. The lay people, in turn, provide the requisites for life, housing, clothes, food, and medicine. This system gave the ordained practitioners more time to study and meditate, so they could progress along the path and thus be able to guide others in society more effectively. This relationship has continued to some extent in all Buddhist traditions, although in various forms. In the Chinese Chan, Zen tradition, work is valued as part of the practice, and monks and nuns tend the fields as well as study and meditate. In Thailand, the vow not to handle money is strictly kept, and the lay people not only provide everything the Sangha needs, but also help with the manual work in the monasteries. In Asia, monks and nuns are generally respected and cared for because those societies value Dharma practice. However, monastics should consider themselves the servants of others, and not become proud when they receive offerings or respect. If they do, their own practice will decline. In the West, the relationship between ordained and lay practitioners is still in its formative stages. It will be influenced by the democratic and less hierarchical nature of Western society. In some ways, this is beneficial. In others, it is harmful. For example, the financial needs of Western ordained Sangha are not always provided for by the monastery or center where they live. As a result, some Western monks and nuns are forced to don lay clothes and find jobs to support themselves. Others have enough to live hand to mouth, but if they become ill or want to travel to receive teachings or do long retreat, they face financial difficulties. When people take ordination, do they reject their family and friends? Not at all. Their deciding not to live a family life themselves does not mean they reject their parents and siblings. Although monastics wish to give up attachment to their family and friends, they still love their family and appreciate their kindness. But they don't limit their affection to a comparatively small group of people. By extending their love to include all others, ordained people seek to develop impartial love for all beings and to consider them as part of their family. They reflect this by working to make the world a better place through their religious practice. By purifying and developing their minds, monastics are able to guide others to lasting happiness through the Dharma. They know this is of great benefit not only to their families but also to society as a whole. Even if they do not attain high realizations in this lifetime, they have a broad vision and work for long-range happiness and benefit. They think, if I continue with my worldly life, my disturbing attitudes will surface, and I'll harm others as well as create the cause for my own unfortunate rebirth. How can I help my family and all others if that occurs? But if I practice the Dharma, my own abilities will increase, and I'll be able to help them better. In this way, their hearts remain connected to their family and to all others, although they do not live a family life as others do. How should parents view their child's becoming a monk or nun? They should be very happy. It's a sign that they have done a good job as parents by instilling in their child a sense of ethical discipline and care for others. Some parents become upset if their child wants to become a monastic. They fear that he or she will not be happy or will lack financial security. Some parents are angry, thinking, "We paid so much for your education. Who will take care of us when we're old if you're in a monastery?" Parents with this attitude mean well and want their child to be happy. But having a family, career, and many possessions is not the only way to happiness. Of course, when Shakyamuni Buddha left his luxurious life at the palace to seek the lasting happiness of enlightenment, his parents were upset too. But parents who understand the Dharma will want their child to be happy now and in the future, and they will understand that religious practice is a way to bring that about. They'll rejoice that their child is devoting him or herself to the noble goals of the Dharma. Is taking ordination a painful sacrifice? It shouldn't be. Ordained people shouldn't feel, "I really want to do these things, but now I have vows and cannot." If they do feel this way, they won't be happy being ordained. Abandoning negative actions should be seen not as a burden, but as a joy. Such an attitude comes from contemplating cause and effect. When we take vows, whether they are the five precepts of a lay person or the vows of a monk or nun, we first generate the attitude, "In my heart, I really don't want to kill, steal, lie, and so on." Sometimes we may be weak in an actual situation and feel tempted to do these things. Taking precepts gives us extra strength and determination not to do what we really don't want to do. For example, we may sincerely want to abandon killing, but when cockroaches are in our flat, we may be tempted to use insecticide. Having taken the precept not to kill, we'll remember that we don't want to kill and will avert the disturbing attitudes that could cause us to act negatively. In this way, precepts are liberating, not confining, for they help us free ourselves from habitual, unwholesome tendencies. Sometimes we encounter Buddhists, both lay and ordained, who are ill-natured and difficult to get along with despite their religious practice. Why is this so? Not all Buddhists are already Buddhas. Some don't take the Buddha's guidance on ethical matters seriously. And even those who do must spend a long time transforming their minds. Dissolving anger isn't an easy process. We can understand this from our own experience. When we are in the habit of losing our temper, it takes more than just saying, "I shouldn't do this," for us to stop. We must practice correctly and continuously in order to avoid falling back into familiar but dysfunctional emotions and behaviors. By training our minds over time, we will be able to channel our energy in different directions. We have to be patient with ourselves, and similarly, we need to be patient with others. We're all fighting the same internal enemies, disturbing attitudes, negative emotions, and imprints of past actions. Sometimes we're strong in confronting them. Other times we're carried away by anger, jealousy, attachment, or pride. It does no good to judge or blame ourselves when we succumb to our negative emotions. Likewise, blaming and criticizing others when they do so is fruitless. Knowing how difficult it is to transform ourselves, we must also be patient with others. As practitioners of the same path, we must try to be harmonious and accept each other's weaknesses. Our job is not to point fingers and say, "Why don't you practice better? Why don't you control your temper?" Our job is to ask ourselves, "Why don't I practice better so their actions won't make me angry?" In addition, we must ask, "What can I do to help them?" Although all practitioners aren't perfect, this doesn't mean the method taught by the Buddha is imperfect. Rather, this indicates that either these individuals do not practice it well, or their practice is not yet strong enough. The Buddha's teachings, however, remain impeccable, and anyone who practices correctly and continues